This is Wade Brathke. That means it's Friday morning. It's 9 to 9:30. We're on Wade's World, KABF, 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power. We're broadcasting from Little Rock, Arkansas. You can live stream this, as you know, at www.kabf.org. And by Monday, we'll have a podcast. You can put it on your website, listen to it, tell your friends about it. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Randy Shaw in San Francisco, California. Randy's a longtime executive director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. Randy, welcome to Wade's World.
Thank you.
Tenderloin, a lot of people are just dreaming still of San Francisco. Where's the Tenderloin in San Francisco?
Well, the Tenderloin is located between Union Square, the elite shopping area, Civic Center, where City Hall is, the wealthy condos of SoMa, and Hayes Valley, which is another wealthy enclave. We're an island of low-income people surrounded by a sea of ever-increasing wealth.
So when we talk about gentrification, you could probably write that book.
Well, the Tenderloin, you know, the book I wrote on the Tenderloin was about how the Tenderloin avoided gentrification and how everybody assumed that a neighborhood located surrounded by such wealth had to be gentrified, and how activists, really for going back 100 years, that's why the title says Sex, Crime, and Resistance. A history of resistance to the establishment in this neighborhood for 100 years has sort of prevented it from being gentrified.
We organize in Dharavi in the middle of Mumbai, which is, you know, a million people surrounded by luxury apartments now looking down the mangrove groves, and we have the same kind of situation. But and part of why we're talking today is we did an excerpt in this coming issue of Social Policy, which will be out at the time this you hear this interview with Randy. Randy wrote a book called The Tenderloin, Sex, Crime, and Resistance in the Heart of San Francisco, and we had a great excerpt. But what's the message? You've been organizing decades here.
So 30, 35 years.
I knew it was over 30, but you know, who counts after 30? So you've seen big changes here, yes or no?
Well, you know, I think, you know, the Tenderloin, the irony of the Tenderloin is from like 1907 into the 50s, it was a great neighborhood, successful neighborhood, booming neighborhood, and then a series of attacks from City Hall on the core economic function of the Tenderloin sent it into a spiral in the late 50s, and it's taken us almost 50 years to recover. It's been a very hard journey back, despite the sense that San Francisco has been booming, rents are through the roof, but the Tenderloin has not seen that kind of growth.
Well, we talk about executive cities sometimes, Vancouver, Seattle, San Francisco, where working families, middle-income families, really can't afford to live anymore.
Well,
San Francisco.
The Tenderloin is going to be essentially the last affordable neighborhood or low-income neighborhood, because we've taken so much of our housing off the market. And that really is what distinguishes the mission, which gets a lot of publicity. The mission failed to aggressively take nonprofit housing, nonprofit ownership, and take private market off. So when you look at what they've done in the mission, is they fought battles against development, but they didn't acquire land as we did in the Tenderloin. And we've almost over a third of this housing in the whole Tenderloin is off the speculative market. So when you have block after block of buildings that are not subject to the speculation and the growth in rents, that's how you preserve neighborhoods. There's really no other way.
And how did y'all acquire that land? I know that's a fight.
Well, you know, what's interesting is it was a long fight to originally save the Tenderloin from development, but we had nonprofits, religious groups, and residents. And one of the great misconceptions about the Tenderloin, the perception, and one of the main reasons I think the book is important, there's a perception that everyone in the Tenderloin is a down-and-out ex-drug dealer, homeless person, that they're all kind of people in need of deep care and they're broken. There are people like that, but the vast majority have always been working people. And I always say, if the Tenderloin residents were so broken down, how did we win all these fights? We had Dianne Feinstein as mayor of San Francisco in 1985, the most pro-development mayor in the history of San Francisco. Every project's approved. Whatever developers got, whatever they want. We got a huge down zoning and restrictive zoning that she signed in 1985. How did that happen? Organizing by residents. And, you know, I describe in the book how people had negative perceptions, and the activists were very clever. We always had senior women as a spokespeople. So, like, I show pictures in the book of Wynne Cottrell, white hair, speaks very nice, retired person. And the public's starting to say, and the politicians,
That's not a drunk hooker.
Right, wait a minute. We don't want to displace those people.
Yeah.
We need to keep them in the Tenderloin. And so the senior in the so-called gray ghetto, we turned into an asset.
Well, I think that's important because you started here 35 years ago. It must be mid-70s.
1979.
And I know in the book you describe some of the first campaigns dealing with specific, almost SRO hotels, right?
Well, we waged, at the Tenderloin waged a historic campaign, historic in the whole United States because nothing had ever achieved this, where we had these three luxury hotels, then the Ramada, Holiday Inn, you know, these big hotels, who Hilton, you know, national, international hotel chains coming against a bunch of ragtag Tenderloin folks. And it just turned out that my entry to the Tenderloin was during that time, so I got very engaged meeting all the residents, fighting the fight, and we ended up winning these historic concessions. They had to give us all kinds of money for housing. That became very common, linkage. It happened in Boston, other cities. Now it's standard, a developer builds. But this had never happened in the United States, where tourist hotels had can buy housing for low-income people, which occurred. We got four hotels out of it and a lot of money. So it was a real breakthrough.
Transferred over to the nonprofit.
Right. They had to buy four hotels and sell and give them to a nonprofit, which was unprecedented. And again, these aren't luxury.
It still is in a lot of places.
These aren't luxury condos. These are tourist hotels, which usually aren't required to do anything for low-income people. So it showed you where the Tenderloin was. And then the really brilliant thing, which I describe in the book, is instead of just saying, okay, whew, we got through that, let's rest for a bit, the rezoning of the Tenderloin proceeded so that you couldn't build any more tall buildings.
Now that, there has to be a big story there because that's almost impossible. I know whether it's New Orleans and their restricted zoning on tall buildings in the French Quarter, which was a huge fight. It tends to be preservationists who lead that fight, not people who are trying to keep and protect low and moderate income housing.
Well, what was so brilliant about the activists that led those fights is that they combined the battles. They basically said, hey, if you're going to approve these three luxury hotels on the board of the neighborhood, you need to protect the rest of the neighborhood. So it became like, even the mayor, they felt kind of bad. They were letting these hotels go through, so they said they'd protect the residential portion. So they struck at exactly the right time. If they had waited, it never would have happened. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's all timing. And you know, people often say to me, how do you stop gentrification? I say, you got to take action now. Don't wait till a project comes out and say, okay, we got to stop this project. Look at your zoning now and rezone it before there's a project that's challenging you.
You know, there's a similar situation in the lower downtown east side, as it's called in Vancouver, where, once again, it was a pocket. Vancouver's also gone this hugely, you know, massive development, high-end. Something that was worth 20,000 is now worth a million, that kind of thing. And they did a certain amount of low-income housing, but never the scale of what you're talking about, the broker deal with luxury hotels that gave you what you ended up with.
Well, I think the other important thing was that if you look at where housing, you know, development, because we limited it to 8 stories in much of the neighborhood, people figure, well, why build here? I can build 13 stories, 20 stories. Why do I want to just build 8 stories? And land values in the Tenderloin, because it's so located near Union Square and, you know, the really elite areas, they've never been cheap. This is not like a low-income, it's a low-income neighborhood with
all
high land
values. All the developers want height in order to lower the cost. That's
exactly
a very important point.
Exactly. So by restricting the height, and we didn't let commercial buildings, because a lot of the development in San Francisco into the 90s was commercial tourist development, and we didn't allow that. You can't build anything non-residential in the Tenderloin above the second floor. So we have very restrictive zoning. The Mission did not have that restrictive zoning, and they let people ended up coming in and building gentrifying projects.
And maybe I'm wrong. Obviously, I'm not an expert on San Francisco, but so much of the Mission fight was also about the old Victorian houses and... Maybe I'm wrong, but it wasn't about holding mass housing for people.
Well, the irony of the Mission, there was always been an issue of rising rents, evictions in the Mission, and gentrification, but they did take, and they did a rezoning, but not as sufficient as a 10-to-1 rezoning. Mm-hmm. They never really aggressively had a proactive strategy, and I think that's been, it's too much like, we're going to turn out a lot of people, we're going to oppose this project, instead of what do we proactively do so we don't have to worry about these projects? There was just a lack of proactive focus. And the Tenderloin also, you know, people really felt, I remember in 1980 going to this meeting and hearing about these hotels and thinking like, I can't believe it. We just opened the Tenderloin Housing Clinic and now our whole neighborhood's going to be destroyed. We really felt like the neighborhood was literally, survival was at stake. It was a desperate fight. And maybe it was less desperate in the Mission until the last few years.
We're talking to Randy Shaw, who's the executive director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. He's written a recent book. It's out now, right?
It's out, yes.
It's out now, but it's also being excerpted in Social Policy. So you've been executive director for how long? You're telling me how large the THC is. It's huge.
Yes.
26 million? I mean, that sticks in your ear as it goes by.
Well, we decided, we wanted to, my goal, we opened the clinic in February 1, 1980, and my goal was always to, you know, restore the working class people and long-term residents to the SROs, which have been really run down and used for temporary housing and all that. And now my organization leases 18 hotels. We're the major housers of formerly homeless people in San Francisco.
Gotcha.
And what has happened now, just like we did in the 80s, is we have an organizing base because we have all these tenants in hotels, and that's who we have a clear organizing base. We have tenant organizers in all the hotels, and they build base. So when we have big political fights, we have a base. It's SRO residents who have led the fight to improve the Tenderloin. And that's important because people often think, well, it's the gentry and the elite who want to like get rid of crime and bring in new businesses. No, it's the working people, the low-income people who say, I don't want to walk by this drug dealer.
Now, when you say SRO, because it's not everybody lives in New York and San Francisco, single residency occupancy, what are we talking about, SRO?
We're talking about rooms that, for the most part, they have no kitchens, and most have no private bathrooms. Some do, but because the Tenderloin has a lot of housing with no kitchens and without private bathrooms, there's only so much someone's going to pay in rent.
Sure.
Like I say, the gentry don't want to live without a kitchen.
Much less a bathroom.
Yeah, and most, as I say, and the rooms are also, you know, in the Tenderloin, 10 by 12. So it lends itself to, it's always been a working class home. Now it's more a lot of people who are disabled, people who are on welfare, and working people as well, because working people can't afford apartments. So, you know, people stay in the SROs. We have a lot of employees who live in our SROs because they got a good deal in the SROs. And, you know, they can get a little micro kitchen, so what do they worry about cooking? You know, they don't worry about it. We've done some electrical work so they can do hot plates in their rooms. They don't need to spend $1,800 for a studio, and we've got a room for $500 in an SRO.
So is any of it Section 8, or is it all?
None of ours is Section 8. We have a lot of Section 8 in the Tenderloin, a lot of senior Section 8 here, yes.
Oh, okay. And how much compared to what you have as SROs?
How much in the
Tenderloin?
In terms
of housing stock.
Well, the Tenderloin has, you know, we have about 5,000 SROs. I would say almost over a quarter of our housing stock is SROs. The Tenderloin is very unusual because we have one single family home, 31 blocks, one single family home was built in the 50s. Very few flats.
And the tour should go by that.
Yes.
Here is our single family home.
I always say the gentry like to own, and we don't have a lot of ownership opportunities in the Tenderloin, and plus we prevent it, and you can't do condominium. We have all these laws to protect the Tenderloin housing stocks, so you can't convert to condominiums. You can't do a lot of the things that happen routinely in New York, Los Angeles, and other places.
That developers are the ones calling this. And you're actually, we're ahead of this, but you were telling me that the Tenderloin's about to have a museum here in just
July 16th, the Tenderloin Museum will open, and anyone listening, if they come to San Francisco,
yeah, they can be right here for the opening.
You know, I always say that if you haven't been to San Francisco before, you probably wouldn't want to stop at the museum for your first trip, but if you've been here once, you got to go here for your second trip because you're going to see a part. We have 409 buildings on the list, National Registry of Historic Places. This is where the Grateful Dead got their start. This is where Miles Davis used to play. And we've got a lot of amazing history. Muhammad Ali boxed here. We have an amazing unknown history, which my book and the museum kind of bring back to life.
Museum's not small.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We realize it's 3,200 square feet, and we realize there's only so much time, given all the tourist competition in San Francisco, that people want to spend in a museum.
Sure.
So the thought is, spend 45 minutes in the museum and take one of our guided resident tours. So we'll have residents giving people guided tours, go into the building, see the beautiful, you know, these buildings are beautiful. Everyone thinks SROs are run down and seedy. Not in the Tenderloin. We do have a few like that, but the most are beautifully restored. You would think you're back in 1910. I mean, it looks exactly like that.
Now, do you have rent control as well here in San Francisco?
Yes, we have very strong rent control, which it's hard to stop gentrification without it. You have eviction protections. You know, you read a lot about, there's a lot of thing called Ellis evictions, people being evicted for no fault. There's almost no fault evictions in the Tenderloin because it doesn't happen here. So that's another advantage that we
have. And how long have you been able to have rent control? When was that one?
79.
So right at the same time you were starting.
Exactly. So a lot of things.
That was another good confluence of...
You know, a lot of things we got passed in the early, late 70s, early 80s. And then in 1990, we got this... I spent 10 years trying to improve this ordinance to protect SROs. And we got that in 1990. And then I went up to the state legislature and got a bill passed in 2003 that protected us from any state preemption SROs. So SROs are safe. And there's also, when I started... The establishment wanted to demolish SROs. We had the famous International Hotel, which everyone's heard of, which got demolished and evicted. And they were just south of market with redevelopment. They just demolished thousands of SROs. So there was a real feeling like SROs are a problem. You can't have a good neighborhood. And we turned that around. Now, everybody politically supports SROs. There isn't anyone in the political realm in San Francisco who says, get rid of SROs. The most conservative supervisors support SROs. So we've kind of won the PR battle.
Fighting against preemption, I didn't realize that, but you know that turns out to be such an issue now. This sort of devolution, there's going to be a piece in the same social policy that I have that I actually originally did based on some stuff in Scotland. You know, devolution is a mixed thing. I mean, they're all, Scotland Acorn is all very excited about devolution because they're going to be able to maybe win rent control there and security of tenure, but we haven't done well on devolution in the U.S.
Well, I'll tell you, in California, tenants have never had had a more difficult time in Sacramento, despite the fact we have Democrats running the legislature completely, and Jerry Brown, Democratic governor. But these Democrats, we had this big thing to try to stop all these evictions, and the person who was the deciding vote was committee was a guy who used to work for the California Teachers Association and 100% labor record, but he goes against tenants because tenants don't give campaign contributions. Landlords do. The realtors have such power. It's kind of remarkable, you know, not only in 2003 did I get some laws passed, but we had a guy named John Burton, who you probably know, currently head of the state Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. When he was in the legislature, he really could twist arms and move stuff. We got stuff.
He's a legend in California.
Yeah, but the last 10 years have been grim at the state level for tenants in California.
Well, and, you know, this won't surprise you, but places like Little Rock, where we're broadcasting from, has always been dominated by real estate interest. I mean, speculation is almost a promotion.
Well, this is the thing about real estate.
Whether it's blockbusting or, you know.
Real estate is everywhere. I mean, California is a really big state. And in some states, some districts aren't really an active tenant. You know, tenants aren't involved or whatever. We have a big Latino population. Latino tenants often aren't involved. So these guys just feel they can vote any way they want and take the realtor's money and then vote against tenants. But the Tenderloin, fortunately, got that thing passed in 2003, which saved all the SROs in San Francisco.
Well, and you're actually, I think you probably realize the point you're making, but what we're finding on Acorn International is private tenants, because particularly outside of the U.S., social housing, you know, public housing, or whatever we might call it, was so dominant up until only the last couple of years, when you're starting to see in the UK and Italy and other places, you're starting to see private sector housing, and there's no organization among private sector tenants.
No, it's a problem.
So where you at least had some voices for people in social housing, those voices are muted. I mean, leases that don't go over 3 months to 6 months. I mean, even in the U.S., somebody pretends to have a lease that's often a year, but we're having to win those fights in places like the U.K. now, which would be unbelievable to you.
Yeah, and of course, the big picture is, you know, one thing I realized when I was here in the 80s is we thought the Tenderloin was moving forward, and then the impact of the Reagan administration was so dramatic. I remember in 1987 thinking, I didn't realize the impact of the Reagan administration, because he got elected in 80 and we had all these projects take a while for the Carter money to be approved, so things got built in 85, they were under Carter, you know.
Yeah.
And you start realizing that the Tenderloin was so dependent on federal money that we were, as I described, we were on an upsurge to 86, and then we just went on a steep decline again because no more federal money for anything. Housing, exactly. Our disabled people were thrown off the rolls. You know, it just became, so we have been hurt by the lack of federal money in the Tenderloin.
You know, people often, that's a fascinating point that probably, you know, you, me, and the rats in our pocket are interested in. I'm not sure about anybody else, but one of the biggest crises we ever had in Acorn was from 84 until 90, because you had all those groups who had started getting, I mean, even not just ourselves, but groups that were on LEAA money. And I mean, so much of the sort of mix of funding was included because there had been Democratic presidents.
And it's never come back. And
this never is what come I, back.
I mean, under Clinton, under Obama,
for it.
It's never come back.
The sort of defunding of the left
exactly.
became institutionalized.
And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is how the people who were the main organizers for the Tenderloin campaign in 1980 were from VISTA. In those days, VISTA exactly. could only be used for organizing, not service. Now we have AmeriCorps, which is strictly service. No one's allowed to do any organizing with federal, with AmeriCorps. So there was a... That's a humongous shift, because without those VISTA workers, there's no way we win that Tenderloin campaign.
People are always amazed when I describe the early staff for Acorn in 1970 and 71. It was me, and then it was seven or eight young, mainly VISTA women, yeah. who I managed yeah. to, you know, convince they were bored to death, and this was 70, and, you know, times were changing, and the VISTA supervisor would look the other way, and, you know, I was paying Gary Delgado after a year or two of it. It was just the two of us making $20, $30 a week because we were changed. Everybody else was on VISTA.
Yeah, we're very fortunate in San Francisco, and I always make it clear that, you know, we've had, the Tenderloin's had its share of difficulties, but, you know, we do have funding organizing in San right. Francisco. I mean, we do have an infrastructure of funding of progressive groups that you don't have in other cities frequently. I mean, it's, so we have organizers on my staff. We have a whole organizing department, and we organize people daily, you know, so it's like a, we constantly turn, we're always turning people out at hearings and things, and have built political clout.
And you need to.
Right. But if you don't have the VISTA program, you don't have, some groups can't do organizing because they just can't get the funding to do it.
Well, but, you know, credit to where credit belongs. I mean, a lot of groups from 70s, from that period, 79 on, that hunkered down on community development particularly, yeah. thought they needed to run from organizing rather than understand, yeah. as obviously the Tenderloin Housing Clinic did, that they needed to keep organizing constantly if they were going to win.
So no, you're absolutely right.
And I think don't take away your own props, brother.
Well, I think the message of the Tenderloin book is that this is a neighborhood that has done more organizing, arguably, than any other neighborhood in San Francisco. It's not an accident. I keep saying, people say gentrification is inevitable, like, and they talk about New York and these places, and I say, well, how is it inevitable when Zubin Bloomberg upzoned 35% of the city when he was mayor? That didn't make it inevitable. Those are laws. They have these crazy developer subsidies in New York City. Those are laws. In San Francisco, we organized in the Tenderloin. We fought things. Developers who wanted to, like, skirt the zoning. I once had a meeting where the developer said, we were planning on building a 30-story building. And I said, well, the zoning only allows 8 stories. And he said, well, zoning can change. And I said, it's not going to change in the Tenderloin. Of course, they lost. So we have used our political organizing that no one wants to come in here and get in a fight with us because, you know, we've just shown that we will turn people out, and it's just a constant battle. And one of the advantages of having SRO tenants, many of whom do not have full-time jobs, they're available to work during the day.
That's what we used to call daytimers. That was your most valuable list. We're talking to Randy Shaw, a 35-year veteran of organizing in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. We're talking about his new book, The Tenderloin, Sex, Crime, and Resistance in the Heart of San Francisco. But this is not your first book. You've written as well about Chavez.
The Activist Handbook.
The Activist Handbook was well known for a long time. Beyond Cron, is that still alive?
Beyond Cron is our website that we run. We still do articles and do a lot of coverage of San Francisco, beyondcron.org. But this book was something that, you know, 35 years I've worked here, but I didn't know any of the history until I started researching it. It was like, nobody knew this history. And, you know, we have 118 pictures, so people can kind of have it come to life. Like the social policy article has a lot of pictures. It's just like, I felt like, oh God, I was living here. I didn't know the Black Hawk Jazz Club was here. I didn't know that the Grateful Dead recorded their first big album here where they were singing Ripple and Sugar Magnolia. You know, I didn't know that. You know, and so it's like, nobody knows it. It's like a neighborhood that's like time forgotten. The gay lesbian movement in San Francisco began in the Tenderloin. This is where it began. There's no dispute about that. But people don't think so. They think it began in the Castro. So, you know, there's just all this history that we think that it's going to also... The residents are so excited about the museum because it's resident pride. Instead of feeling you're a failure if you live in the Tenderloin, we're switching it to like, you know what, everyone feels lucky to live here. I'm living in this great historic neighborhood. It's great. My rents aren't an issue. I can be here the rest of my life. That's important. Instead of people who have to worry, hey, if I work to improve my block, I might get evicted, which is a risk, not a risk in the Tenderloin.
So I'm sure on the museum there must be a website where people can also see some of these pictures.
TenderloinMuseum.org.
Okay.
And they, as I say, come to San Francisco, and by all means, starting after July 16th, come visit, because I think that people, you know, as again, if you've been to San Francisco before, you've been to the wharf, you've seen Chinatown, you know, you've seen kind of the major sites, this will make you special. We have the amazing collection of old historic garages. They got torn down other places. Our garages are here from the 1920s, you know?
And so when you do the walking tour, what would people see as they walk through the Tenderloin?
They'd see
a couple of blocks up. So.
They'd see the historic SROs, all the old buildings. You know, most of our buildings are still the ones from 1910. We have very little built after 1930. We have the old garages. You see the neon signs, you know, the whole, and a lot of street life. And, you know, a lot of times people don't, they get freaked out now if they see anyone else on the street. But Tenderloin, people are out now and having fun. They're talking. It's probably like New Orleans. You know, people are out. The community is out. People don't want to be in their SRO rooms all the time, so they go out on the sidewalk.
Well, New Orleans is too hot to be inside here. I mean,
right.
You told me to bring a coat.
Yes,
so summer is different here. But yeah.
Definitely different. But, you know, you have people who the street is part of their life. They don't feel they have to be in their room all the time. Originally, the Tenderloin had billiard places and pool halls and bathhouses and bowling alleys because tons of bars and restaurants because people couldn't eat in their room, so they have to go out, have fun.
And if it's you didn't have bathrooms in your room, you needed bathrooms,
exactly.
For goodness sake.
Exactly. So we had dance halls. You know, it was just a real fun place, and we were trying to bring it back to those days. We're trying to bring back. We were always a bar and restaurant. What killed the Tenderloin in the 50s, we were the gambling capital of the Bay Area. Governor Brown's grandfather and his father's father.
Governor Brown, right.
Ran a gambling hall in the Tenderloin. So Jerry Brown, our current governor, whose father, Pat Brown, was governor, he used to work for his father in a poker club in the Tenderloin. Then he ran for district attorney in an anti-corruption campaign. That's how it is in San Francisco. Everyone was enjoying the Tenderloin, but they were against vice. And that's what
you know,
and
this will probably be an episode of True Detective on HBO next week. So, okay, so people can go to TenderloinMuseum.org.
Correct.
There is a walking tour that's connected to that, and y'all have done a walking tour to help build support and understanding the Tenderloin for several years.
Right.
I know that's been important. And your book came out exactly when?
End of April.
End of April.
Yeah.
So it's been out a couple of months,
right.
And I'm sure that's available in the Tenderloin.
It's available,
as well.
Right, yes.
People don't, it's important to realize, and I'll underline a point you made a minute ago, we're only a couple blocks from City Hall, right?
City Hall, which the Tenderloin residents, working people, built in 1915. It's its 100th anniversary, just celebrated 2 weeks ago. We built the Civic Center. That's why people moved to the Tenderloin, the working people, because they could walk to work. And even Union Square, we are close to everything. All the major tourist hotels are all within walking distance, and we hope those folks come and visit the museum.
So the museum opens July 16th. What's the next 5 or 10 years like for THC?
Well,
there must be some other projects y'all are thinking
well,
about.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, for me, we're going to see how the museum goes and see. We need to make the Tenderloin a safer neighborhood. It's been a 35-year campaign of mine, and people are very, the residents. We need to really make it so that it's not simply a place people have to live, but where they want to live.
And
we're still working on that. They're still making progress. There's a lot in the air. We got this great children's program. It's kind of nationally known, called 826 Valencia, which I spent a year and a half recruiting. Dave Eggers founded it, co-founded it, to come into the neighborhood, a writing program for youth, and they have a retail store. They're coming 2 blocks from the museum. So we're opening an art gallery to sell the work of Tenderloin artists, so people living in the Tenderloin can make money off their art, which is very difficult for them. So we're trying to do a lot of things to build the Tenderloin economy to benefit those living here.
Great. And Dave Edgar certainly is a name a lot of people know now. We're almost to the end, Randy. We didn't even get to talk about Chavez. I'll have to get you on the phone. We'll do this again. But tell people again where they can find the Tenderloin Housing Clinic if they want to give you all some support more about it.
Right, thclinic.org. The Tenderloin Sex Crime Resistance in the Heart of San Francisco is on Amazon or any other booksellers you can find. It's widely available. AK Press is releasing it. And the museum, TenderloinMuseum.org.
And if people want to learn how to organize tenants and fight some of these developments, they can reach out to...
Also, they can read my activist handbook, which goes into all that.
Excellent. This has been Wade's World, WWWKBF. If you've been live streaming, as I said, the podcast with Randy's remarks will be on Monday. We'll be with you again next week. This has been Wade's World at 100,000 watts, KBF 88.3, the voice of the people. Thank you.